Here comes Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo, number 284. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, with rebroadcasts on CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake and CHLS in Lillooet. Military recruiters have a strange new gimmick in their quest to snatch young bodies as cannon fodder. Governments are encouraging maimed veterans of our wars against Afghanistan and Iraq to use their newfound disabilities as credentials, allowing them to participate in future Paralympics. Step right up, young men and women. Have no fear of coming back from our foreign wars in a basket. You can be trained to play ping pong with your nose. Fame awaits you. The new recruiting slogan to come is, be all you can be, even if you're not all there. If you think that's sick, you're overlooking the fact that our wars are altogether sick. Did you know that the American war against Iraq is in pursuit of God's will? It must be so, as the Republican vice presidential candidate said so. She told her constituents that it's also God's will that a pipeline be constructed to carry Alaskan crude oil and gas to the lower 48 states. Is anyone else uncomfortable with the idea of having a person next in line for the most powerful position on earth who thinks that God whispers in her ear? Does it make sense to have such a person backing up an old man who suffers, or certainly should suffer, post-traumatic stress syndrome after 5 years as a prisoner of war? Maybe as dog catcher, but not as president of the USA. If this team wins power in the United States of America, we neighbors, as well as the rest of the world, could be in deep doo-doo. Deeper doo-doo. Mitt Romney, former Massachusetts governor and contender for the Republican presidential nomination, came out with a remarkable comment a couple of weeks ago. He said, "We need change, all right. Change from a liberal Washington to a conservative Washington. We have a prescription for every American who wants to change in Washington. Throw out the big government liberals and elect John McCain." Where the hell has this clown been for the last 8 years? Or perhaps he's so far off to the loony libertarian right that he thinks George Bush is a liberal. Conservatives have had 2 terms in which to do their damage to the United States and the world. Thank goodness that this clown Romney wasn't selected to run. His endorsement of McCain and his peculiar partner give us no comfort. We're all comforted knowing that airlines are concerned with passenger safety above profit. They're glad to see us surrendering dangerous bottled beverages so they can sell us government-approved water on board. They encourage passengers to be good consumers by charging for baggage or encouraging them to lose their own instead of leaving the job to the airline. Now Air Canada's Jazz is saving precious fuel, lightening loads further by eliminating the useless frill of life vest from some of their planes. Well, it makes sense. When was the last time that you needed a life vest on a flight? Now, I wonder if they're also trimming fuel loads so they have just enough to reach their planned destinations. Think of that the next time you find yourself circling an airport awaiting clearance of congestion so you can land. Airlines assure us there is no problem. They haven't left a plane up there yet. With the Canadian death toll in Afghanistan pushing 100, you probably think that being a soldier is a very dangerous job. 100 deaths at work is nothing. In China last year, there were 3,800 coal miners reported killed on the job, and that is just reported deaths in a land where cover-up is common. 10 deaths a day in any occupation is a heavy toll. When I mined in Ontario, we were subject to the Ontario Mining Act. Government inspectors came through the mines right up to the drilling face to make sure the proper equipment and procedures were used. Deaths were rare in spite of conditions that begged accidents. Apparently, mining in China is a free-for-all for operators. Coal mine is inherently more dangerous than hard rock mining, I know, and allowing companies to do as they please is a recipe for repeated disasters. Before we define China as a member of the Club of Developed Nations, they'll have to clean up their act in terms of government regulation and oversight of citizen safety on and off the job. Meanwhile, we're going the other way, as illustrated by Harper's government turning oversight of worker and consumer safety over to the very corporations that will gladly cut corners. Maple Leaf Cold Cuts, anyone? The Fraser Institute made my day by dropping the latest copy of their quarterly publication, The Canadian Student Review, in my mailbox. Not only is this magazine informative, but it offers a contest with a top prize of $2,000 for the best essay on the topic, Incentives Matter, Fixing Health Care in Canada. For those taking up the challenge, I have a hint. Make sure you advocate turning your medical system over to private enterprise lock, stock, and barrel. Take this suggestion from the article following the contest announcement entitled The Case for Capitalist Healthcare. This issue also reports a new study showing that poverty in Canada is not increasing. Pay no attention to contrary reports. The Fraser Institute promotes a new book on climate change, available free in PDF format on the Internet. It professes to demonstrate that human activities are but a minor element in global warming, so we need not impair corporate rapacity. A major article begins with a paragraph, "Although many people believe governments are better at delivering services than the free market, evidence shows that government failure is all too common. I suppose this means we should withdraw all restrictions and regulation, called by the Fraser Institute red tape, and trust corporations to look after our welfare. Like we can trust Maple Leaf to look after food safety. Like we can trust Exxon to set standards for oil tanker traffic. Like we're trusting corporations to look after the environment of northern Alberta as they rip up the tar sands. Like we can trust American financial institutions to look after debt." I recommend any of the publications of the Fraser Institute to those interested in the function of alleged think tanks as propaganda vehicles. We have an excellent example of what happens when corporations are left to police their own operations, as advocated by the Fraser Institute. Bacterial contamination of luncheon meats produced by Maple Leaf killed Canadians. Harper's government denied that it pulled inspectors off production lines, but this assertion is refuted by the union representing those doing the work. The union revealed that inspectors were relegated to reviewing reports issued by the company on its own safety performance. Government employees are no longer continuously supervising production. Not only have inspectors been relieved of the task of actually viewing meat assembly, or should I say disassembly lines, but Harper's government has actively lobbied the United States to reduce their safety standards as applied to Canadian producers of meats for export. This is disgusting, and Harper's conservatives should be held to account for trying to reduce consumer safety. Where is Canada headed? Under a conservative majority, would we reach that Fraser Institute ideal where government allows corporations to set and monitor their own standards? What the hell, if we can't trust corporations, what's capitalism all about? We have nothing to fear, but fear itself is the message from Bush for those watching the collapse of the investment banking business in the States. Don't fret those billions or trillions lost as the housing bubble ripples its way through the world economy. What the hell, eh? When I heard that Merrill Lynch was forced into the maw of the Bank of America, I was reminded of a co-worker of mine in California. Nilo Giannini might have been the happiest man I ever knew. He worked as a packer in the warehouse of the electrical supplier in which I earned my bread. All day he prepared outgoing shipments for pickup, reusing cartons from incoming materials. Nilo was a small, quiet man who kept his own counsel. He was not up on the news, and I suppose any intelligence test would have scored him low. He lived with his mother in a neighborhood where they had lived for years. He owned several houses in the area, renting them out and busying himself doing his own maintenance and repairs. Nilo made no waves at work. In fact, the only problem I ever heard that management had with him was in prodding him to cash his paychecks. Every so often, the bean counters in San Francisco would remind him to take his accumulation to the bank so they could balance their books. One day, Nilo and I had a conversation involving rent, as my landlord was having trouble with turnover of tenants in his semi-slum properties. Nilo said he had no trouble with his tenants, as they stayed for years and years. His secret was that he never raised rents. He had full houses renting for $50 a month. Even in those days, this was about a quarter of the going rates. No wonder none of his tenants ever moved. A rental like that you leave only in your will. How could he afford to forget to cash his paychecks and rent for almost nothing? I found that the secret was in his name, Giannini. He was one of the heirs of the founder of the Bank of America. That is now the largest bank in the United States and the only one close to having the assets of Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. If Nilo is still alive, he is most likely living a modest lifestyle in the same little house untroubled by inflation. It's been a while since I heard right-wingers trumpeting the virtues of unbridled free enterprise, that driving force of our economy. You know, those daring individuals and corporations which risk capital in bold new ventures, creating wealth and jobs while supporting us all with their taxes. These capitalists have been incessantly celebrated by their pet propaganda mills like the Fraser Institute. So-called think tanks and their media allies like the National Post never miss a chance to demand less government regulation and lower taxes. Regulations and laws affecting corporate operation are usually called red tape, giving the image of useless hindrances to their production of goods and services to the public. And taxes? Unwarranted theft of the fruits of their labors. It seems that their tune has changed with the collapse of the mountains of their creative debt, mansions built on foundations of sand. Corporations have always fed at the public trough. It took massive bribes of public land to induce them to build our railways. We used to encourage their grandeurs with tariffs on competing products, thus giving them license to amass monopoly profits. The practice continues as we grant huge pools of public money to outfits like Ford and General Motors, some of the first corporations to demand a level playing field, reduction of taxes and regulation when their businesses are booming. AIG, that massive money-making machine of the insurance business, has been found to have amassed much of that profit by taking insurance gambles that it could not back up. Now it has been declared too big to fail, and the U.S. government had to take it over or face a contagion that threatened to bring down the whole financial structure. Right here in Prince George, we're paying the price for this lack of real risk-taking by companies. Horizon Air was induced to initiate direct flights between Prince George and the States by guarantees it could not resist. If the route made money, it was Horizon Air's. If it lost money, as it did, the city would pick up the tab to a maximum of $700,000. This was an odd deal. Ideally, a company considering such a route would have done its due diligence, estimating future passenger loads and taking the risk with its own money if it promised to be profitable. Apparently, our good city council was so taken with the image of our little field becoming an international airport that they would risk our money to make that a reality, although fleeting. Passenger loads were on the order of 30% rather than the 70% that would have taken us off the financial hook, and with the agreement expiring, the service is being canceled. The apt description of our present economy with its massive interventions on behalf of capital is socialism for the rich and capitalism for the rest. I was born in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, a small city renowned for hosting the World Series of Little League Baseball, and nothing else of import. It was amusing to hear some years ago that the rules for that annual contest had been changed to exclude teams from Taiwan. This World Series was to become, effectively, a North American series. And why? Because teams from Taiwan had the audacity to win. I was reminded of this by an article exposing a decision of the Ladies Professional Golf Association to exclude players who are unable to converse in English. Am I being needlessly suspicious that foreign language speakers might have been winning? Or were there other reasons? The official explanation of the LGPA was that its members are among the best athletes in the world, and we need to ensure that all members communicate with our core audiences, fans, sponsors, media, in English throughout their careers in the LGPA. There it is. These golfing exercises are not sport. Their participants have careers supported by sponsors, read advertisers. Those who cannot stand up and promote Nike and their corporate ilk are unwelcome to participate in their contests, no matter what skills they may possess. It's all about convincing couch potatoes watching golf on television to buy overpriced shoes and hats with corporate logos. As the price of Alberta's black gold tumbles, we're urged to turn to exporting Canada's blue gold by a Quebec think tank. This outfit stated publicly that large-scale exports of fresh water would be a wealth-creating idea for Quebec and for Canada as a whole, and that it is urgent to look seriously at developing our blue gold. The Montreal Economic Institute, the think tank in question, has a board of directors characterized as comprised of blue-chip businessmen. It figures. Who else would promote the export of our most precious natural resource? Our share of the world's fresh water has been grossly overestimated. Most of it is in ancient stores, above and below ground, that are only slowly recharged. We'd be terribly foolish to tap these resources beyond that which would be renewed, as there is no doubt that we will need this water in the future. Would we follow the advice of these greedy buggers, those positioned to make quick profits from selling off our future for a quick buck? If Harper wins a majority in this coming election, we're liable to find out. Stéphane Dion claims to have evidence that there have already been secret talks between Ottawa and Washington about water sales to the U.S. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, 94.7 FM on cable. The New Democratic Party bounced a candidate in the federal race for advocating the legalization of marijuana and posting a film on the internet showing him driving while smoking the demon weed. Watch for the coming provincial election where the premier running for re-election is an ex-convict found guilty of driving in Hawaii while drunk, very drunk. Speaking as one who has driven both drunk and stoned, I prefer to share the road with the latter than the former. Drunks go careless, brave, and stupid, driving like maniacs. Potheads are more likely to become overly cautious and drive too slowly, displaying more paranoia than bravado. If I had my druthers, I would keep both off the roads, but certainly drunks like our beloved Gordon Campbell are the greater hazard. Social injustice kills. This is the determination of a study by a Geneva panel chaired by a professor at University College of London. This study, entitled Closing the Gap in a Generation, Health Equity, related economic inequality and mortality, coming to the conclusion that social injustice is killing people on a grand scale. They found that, in countries at all levels of income, health and illness follow a social gradient. The lower the socioeconomic position, the worse the health. Taken at the extreme case, a girl born in hugely unequal Lesotho can expect to live 42 fewer years than one born in more equal Japan. The study challenges the dogma that increased global trade, coupled with cuts in public spending, increases general well-being. This trend is making things worse for the average person, and we don't have to go to Lesotho to see this. As Canadian jobs are outsourced to sweatshops in the third world countries, those fired here are left unemployed or underemployed. Canadian families suffer mentally and physically. We should be asking how much of the burden on our public health system lies with the results of globalization. If we retrenched by bringing those jobs home, would our general health improve? If we increased the minimum wage and sought to bring in a basic standard of welfare to all residents of Canada, might we actually save more in medical expenses, not to mention police, courts, and jails, than the cost of reforms? I don't expect any action in this direction as long as our legislators at all levels are rich men and women profiting from inequality and depression of wages. Isn't it great sport watching yet another American election? I'm fascinated by John McCain's campaigning against himself. For 8 years of the Bush regime, this senator has been a faithful follower of the big wanker and his policies. Why not? With his wife's $100 million fortune backing him, he's certainly been looking after his own class. He has backed deregulation of the economy, the same deregulation of financial markets that let the world into this current mess. He and his fellow senators, none of whom are poverty-stricken, backed tax cuts for the rich while allowing infrastructure to fall apart. Now McCain mounts his soapbox and tells voters that he backs re-regulation and reining in Wall Street. It sounds hollow to me, and with everything else said in this election, his aim not to expose true policies but to win votes. Would McCain tax obscenely large fortunes to help ameliorate the vast gaps in wealth in this country? Would he advocate a wealth tax which might tap those with fortunes of, say, $100 million? Is there any reason for allowing such huge accumulations of unearned wealth? Would McCain be as willing to bail out people losing their homes as he is to save corporations? But of those questions, I leave those questions for another day. Younger listeners will not remember the days when the normal work week was Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. In Canada today, about 30% of the workforce works irregular shifts, and this doesn't include those who are self-employed and find themselves having to be available at all hours. Back in those golden days, the term 24/7 meant the 24th of July. When I moved to Prince George, the town was pretty well shut down all of Sunday and Monday. Some businesses, of course, operated odd hours, but forget banks, hardware, and most food stores. Then came convenience stores filling the gaps and a gradual dissolution of Monday closings for everyone. We haven't reached the state of larger cities where damn near everything is open all the time, but we're working on it. We pay a price for 24-hour convenience. As a survivor of several jobs that kept irregular hours, I can testify they take a toll on health, largely by disrupting sleep patterns. If you've never started work at 5 a.m., as I did on a milk truck, or worked rotating around-the-clock shifts as I did in a steel mill, you may not realize what those odd hours do to your life. And I did these jobs when I didn't have a family, which makes it worse. StatsCan conducted a survey finding that shift workers, not surprisingly, were more likely to be unhappy with their work-life balance. I think we should step back and look at that balance, its costs and benefits. We'll always need some round-the-clock workers at like medical personnel, firefighters, police, public transit operators, and some retailers. But why not encourage Sunday closings again for most? A simple way of promoting a day of rest would be by legislating a meaningful overtime penalty for Sunday work. If employers had to pay double or triple time for that day, it would be a major incentive to close down and give people a rest. There have been agreements in the past where some of the critical businesses would rotate their openings, with designated ones always available when others closed. This has worked with pharmacies and gas stations in some communities. Why not? This is another case where we find that society is under control of the economy. We should recall that the capitalist economy is a construct of society, not the other way around. I could draw a parallel with society and stock markets. Stock markets were established to provide liquidity to the economy, not as an end unto themselves. This is coming to public consciousness as those markets and their fluctuations threaten to floor the actual physical economy. While we weren't looking, the good folks who changed discussions of tar sands to oil sands have dropped another couple of euphemisms on us. You will note that Canada is no longer at war against Afghanistan. Instead, we have a mission there. The psychological effect of the two terms is quite different. The American mission that is killing Afghan civilians wholesale is not an indiscriminate slaughter, as you might think. These killings are minor errors resulting from the American policy of anticipatory self-defense. If American warriors think there might be a militant hiding in an orphanage who might intend at some time in the future to throw a rock at an American tank, it's within their mandate to blow that orphanage to rat shit as anticipatory self-defense. By definition, any innocent party spread about the countryside is merely collateral damage and not really murdered indiscriminately. Another one they slipped in on us in arguments around taxation has been to rebrand inheritance taxes as death taxes. While few leave behind fortunes large enough to be hit with inheritance taxes, everyone can relate to death taxes, as they sound universal. Cows come and go, but the bull goes on forever. When I was in my mid-teens and even more foolish, I had an odd friend. One day we were calmly walking down the main street of our suburb when he suddenly bolted down the sidewalk, scattering pedestrians while repeatedly shouting, "Don't get panicky!" I was reminded of my old friend Charles when reading and hearing of government's reactions to the ongoing collapse of our financial pyramid. The same people who are celebrating the building of this edifice of debt are now in panic mode while watching its unwinding. Governments around the world have ratcheted up the printing presses, flooding hundreds of billions of dollars into shoring up shaky institutions. They're ignoring the long-term danger of inflation in pursuit of putting out the short-term fires of collapsing dominoes of finance. Principal among the rescuers is Bush's government, purportedly staffed with fiscal conservatives opposed to government intervention in world finance. They remind me of the situation of a Christian Scientist with appendicitis as they go against their professed beliefs to save a system. The American fiscal deficit was on target to reach about $600 billion this year. Add to this several hundred billions of public dollars that may find their way down the rat hole of bad loans, and the total could easily surpass a trillion. This should push the total American government debt past the $10 trillion mark by the time Bush Jr. gets the bums rush in January. With the U.S. looking at a public debt of $35,000 for every breathing American, is there any conceivable way that this can ever be paid down without strangling the economy? Romania did this under the late dictator Ceausescu, who paid down his external debt by impoverishing his people and wrecking his economy. Would any democracy be able to get away with doing the same? No, and especially the United States, where politicians are elected on promises of increased spending and tax cuts. There's talk of rating agencies lowering the American sovereign debt rating from its coveted AAA state. It's already considered inferior to the public debt of both Austria and Sweden, attracting higher interest rates. With a lowered credit rating, the U.S. would be forced to pay incrementally higher interest on those borrowed trillions. Even if that interest rate were to increase a mere 0.1%, that would add $10 billion to annual interest payments. Such a phenomenon could have a cascading effect as higher interest rates add to the total owed, enlarging the debt and perhaps making for yet lower credit ratings. Conceivably, if subsequent administrations do not act to reduce or at least freeze their debt, it could be reduced to junk status and then default. If you think that a collapse of Morgan Stanley or AIG would be a disaster, consider the effects of an American government default. I just came across a disturbing statistic, courtesy of the Guardian Weekly. 9% of the prison population of Great Britain is made up of military veterans. This is a much larger than the veteran proportion of the general population. Most of these men served in Afghanistan and or Iraq. The simple explanation is that both of these conflicts are making a mess of the men that their country sends there. There's no reason to believe that British soldiers are more vulnerable to the various breakdowns leading them to prisons than are Canadians. If we extrapolate this finding to Canada, we can expect a burgeoning number of our citizens returning from the Afghan war to end up incarcerated. Add to this the penchant of both liberals and conservatives to increase sentences for crime, and I foresee a serious problem on the horizon for our country. The Prince George Regional Correctional Center is already filled far above its intended capacity. A huge expansion is underway today. Other regional jails are likewise bursting. Federal institutions are following suit. For decades, we'll be paying the penalty for Chretien's hasty jump into George Wanker Bush's war against Afghanistan. If it was the intent of those knocking down the World Trade Center to disrupt Western society, they must be laughing as they suffer the attention of the promised virgins in paradise. This has been the 284th edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo. The home station is CFUR in Prince George at 88.7 FM, and rebroadcasts are carried on CHLS in Lillooet and CJLY in Nelson Kootenai Lake. Sweet dreams, y'all.